From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Stand up!
Get up or you get tased again!
Go!
Get up!
Do
stand
that.
Up! Get up!
So
get
wrong!
Up. Get up! Up! Stand up! Pass up! All right, come stand up!
University police repeatedly shock a UCLA student with a taser gun after he refused to show his ID in a school library. The student, an Iranian-American, was handcuffed the entire time. The incident was captured on video and has sparked outrage across this campus and the country. We'll speak with the Council on American-Islamic Relations, calling for an independent investigation. But first, a Jordanian student arrested after 9/11 is acquitted of perjury. We'll talk with Osama Awadallah and his attorney. And we'll remember Dr. Mike Alkaly. He lived with AIDS for more than 20 years. He died this weekend of leukemia in Oakland, California. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The CIA has reportedly found no conclusive evidence Iran is seeking to develop nuclear weapons. In a new article for The New Yorker magazine, investigative journalist Seymour Hersh reports a secret CIA draft assessment has challenged White House assumptions on Iran's nuclear capabilities and complicated efforts to build momentum for a military strike. A former senior intelligence official said Vice President Dick Cheney is leading the charge to discount the CIA's view. The official said, quote, they're not looking for a smoking gun. They're looking for the degree of comfort level they think they need to accomplish the mission. Cheney's also said to have told a White House meeting 1 month before the midterm elections a Democratic victory would have little effect on the administration's decision to go to war. Just last week, Israel's outgoing ambassador to the U.S., Danny Aiello, told an Israeli newspaper President Bush will not hesitate to use force to stop Iran's nuclear activities. In Iraq, more than 110 people were killed in violence around Iraq Sunday. At least 17 died and 50 were wounded in a suicide attack in the town of Hilla. Meanwhile, insurgents kidnapped Iraq's deputy health minister in what's believed to be the highest-level abduction of an Iraqi official to date. In another major development, Syria's foreign minister was in Iraq Sunday for the first visit by a Syrian minister since the U.S. invasion. The foreign minister, Walid Mualem, offered Syrian assistance in battling insurgents and called for a timetable for withdrawal of foreign troops from Iraq. In other Iraq news, former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger has said he believes a military victory for the United States is impossible. In an interview with the BBC, Kissinger said, quote, if you mean by clear military victory an Iraqi government that can be established and whose writ runs across the whole country, that gets the civil war under control and sectarian violence under control. I don't believe that's possible, he said. Kissinger's advised the Bush administration during the Iraq War. Human Rights Watch is calling the recent trial of Saddam Hussein fundamentally unfair. In a new report released today, Human Rights Watch says the trial was undermined by interference from the Iraqi government and failure to allow an open hearing of evidence and witnesses. President Bush is in Indonesia today as he continues his eight-day tour of Asia. More than 10,000 people took to the streets of the capital, Jakarta, Sunday, ahead of the president's visit. This is Al Nurdin of Indonesia's Islamic Defenders Front.
Various elements from different Muslim civil organizations here have all objected to the devil himself, George Bush, coming to Indonesia. Essentially, we all agreed that Bush is a murderer in the eyes of Muslims across the world.
Protests are continuing in Indonesia today. Meanwhile, a coalition of American human rights, labor, and religious groups are asking President Bush to refrain from promising further assistance to the Indonesian military. In a letter organized by the East Timor Action Network, the groups write, quote, we are deeply troubled by ongoing human rights violations by Indonesia's security forces, especially in Papua, and its widespread impunity for crimes against humanity and other serious violations committed against the peoples of East Timor and Indonesia. Last year, President Bush issued a waiver on a congressional restriction on military assistance to Indonesia. In the occupied territories, the Israeli military called off a planned airstrike in Gaza on the home of a wanted militant Sunday after hundreds of Palestinians gathered at his home to protect it. Hamas activist Nizar Rian described the scene.
In the beginning, hundreds of people gathered, and in less than an hour, there were thousands gathered on the roof. Now the men and women are taking shifts, meaning the morning and said, we will be here during the day, and you cover during the night. Now our sisters sitting on top of the roof have rest inside the house.
An Israeli spokesperson called the Palestinian action, quote, a cynical exploitation of our attempt to avoid harm to civilians. But Palestinian Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh said the tactic had broken new ground and would be used to stop future Israeli attacks.
Israel will not break our will, and we will stand together for a long path, starting by what has happened here today at this house, to protect our house, our children, our women, and our elderly.
In Kenya, a UN summit of environmental ministers wrapped up Friday with promises to take action on climate change in the future. The summit said it would review the Kyoto Accords in 2008 with the possibility of agreeing to further cuts in greenhouse gases. Under Kyoto, signatories must keep their emissions to at least 5% below their 1990 levels before the year 2012. The summit also agreed to fund African initiatives for clean energy. Many African leaders and activists, including Sharon Lurumenta of the Maasai community, said the conference had failed to address Africa's needs.
You came here to look at some climate impacts and some poor people suffering, then climb your airplanes and head home. Africa is sometimes called the forgotten continent, and it looks like you have forgotten us.
In Sudan, the UN's top humanitarian official has once again been barred from visiting Darfur. Jan Egeland, the UN relief coordinator, was forced to end his trip Friday after Sudanese officials stopped him from entering villages housing Darfurian refugees. Egeland spoke after returning to the Sudanese capital of Khartoum.
And never would I have thought that the fear, the angst among the civilian population of Darfur would remain the same after 3 long years.
Here in the United States, up to 22,000 people gathered outside Fort Benning, Georgia, this weekend to call for the closing of the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, formerly known as the School of the Americas. 15 people were arrested after crossing the line onto the base. The U.S. military has used the school to train many Latin American and Caribbean military officials accused of abusing human rights. Protesters heard from a number of survivors of U.S.-backed regimes, including Maria Guardado of El Salvador.
Me tenían atada y vendada.
They had me bound and blindfolded.
Me quemaron que después de 26 años todavía tengo señas de las quemadas.
They burned me in such a way that now, 26 years later, I still have the scars of.
This was the 17th year of the School of America's protests. The weekend actions are timed to coincide with the anniversary of the November 1989 murders of 6 Jesuit priests, their housekeeper, and her daughter in El Salvador. According to the organizers, protests also took place in Argentina, Bolivia, Chile, Colombia, Ecuador, El Salvador, Paraguay, and Peru, as well as in Ireland, Canada, and other cities across the United States. On Capitol Hill, a leading Democratic Congress member has announced plans for legislation to reintroduce the military draft. New York Democrat Charles Rangel, the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee come January, says he believes mandatory conscription would deter politicians from launching wars. Rangel said, quote, there's no question in my mind that this president and this administration would never have invaded Iraq if members of Congress and the administration thought their kids from their communities would be placed in harm's way. A new study of hundreds of hearings where Guantanamo prisoners were deemed enemy combatants has found the U.S. military called no witnesses, withheld evidence, and reached speedy verdicts usually within a day. The study was overseen by Seton Hall professor Mark Denbo and his son Joshua. Both represent Guantanamo prisoners. The hearings were held before a panel of 3 officers with no defense attorney present. Out of nearly 560 prisoners, all but 38 were ruled enemy combatants. And finally, 2 military veterans and a Catholic priest have been sentenced to prison time for staging a disarmament protest at a North Dakota missile silo last June. The men dressed in clown suits broke the locks on the site using sledgehammers. They painted the word disarm and poured some of their own blood on a silo lid. The men called themselves Weapons of Mass Destruction Here Plowshares. The three were each ordered to pay restitution of $17,000. The oldest of the group, 73-year-old priest Father Carl Cabot, was given the longest sentence of 15 months. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Friday, Jordanian immigrant Osama Owadalla was acquitted of federal charges that he lied to a grand jury investigating the September 11th attacks. 10 days after the attacks, Owadalla, who was then a student at Grossmont College outside San Diego, was taken into custody and held as a material witness. Agents detained Owadalla after they found a scrap of paper with his name and telephone number in a car at Dulles National Airport in Washington, D.C. The car belonged to Nawaf al-Hazmi, one of the 9/11 hijackers. Osama Owadalla spent much of the next 20 days in solitary confinement, where he was treated as a high-security risk. He was released on bail in November of 2001 as he awaited trial. Owadalla's case was thrown out once, reinstated by a federal appeals court, then delayed for almost a year while prosecutors tried unsuccessfully to have the judge removed because of claims of bias. When the case finally reached trial earlier this year, the jury ended in a deadlock. Until Friday, Osama Owadalla faced the possibility of 10 years in prison and deportation. He joins us in the studio now, along with Sarah Kunstler, an attorney on the case, and we welcome you both to Democracy Now! How did it feel to have those verdicts of not guilty repeated over and over again on Friday? How many times?
It was 27 times of saying not guilty. And each one after another was just, you know, an indescribable feeling of how, you know, justice is being done in my case. Well, I cannot describe my feeling, but I knew I were innocent, and I knew in this great country that justice system is good enough in order for me to be acquitted, and the jury were great, and it happened. I just, you know, was so happy and was waiting for that, you know, final verdict of the 27. You know, when they said not guilty, it's like, you know, mountains were removed out of, you know, from my back, and it's just like a newborn, new life to me.
What did you do next? Was your family in the audience?
My father was in the audience. Was the first one that I greeted and hugged. And then I greeted my lawyers, and we just waited so I can go and thank the jury and, you know, speak with them and see how they felt. And it was just amazing.
Sarah, this was not the first trial. Can you explain the series of trials?
Well, this case was initially the indictments were thrown out by Judge Shira Shinlin. We went to the first trial in April of 2005.
And the indictment at the time was?
The indictment was reinstated. It was two counts of perjury with 27 specifications. And in 2005, the government appealed a pretrial ruling and stalled trial basically right after jury selection. It took another year for that appeal to be resolved, and April of 2006, we proceeded to trial again. In that trial, it was 10-1 to convict Mr. Owadalla. It was a hung jury with one holdout juror who had reasonable doubt as to his guilt.
Now, explain the perjury charges. Why originally was Osama arrested and charged with what? What is the whole story of the grand jury for those who aren't familiar with it?
He was arrested, He was originally questioned because an old phone number of his was found in a vehicle belonging to one of the hijackers who flew into the Pentagon. It was actually a phone number that hadn't been his for over a year and had only been registered in his name for a 2 or 3 month period a year before. He was brought in for questioning and shortly after arrested on a material witness warrant, which the government can use to detain people who aren't, when there isn't probable cause, when they aren't charged with crimes, solely to bring them to testify before grand juries when it's determined that there is a probability that they won't go on their own voluntarily on subpoena. So he was brought to New York, treated as a not just a high risk. He was treated as a high risk inmate, and kept in solitary confinement, subject to ill treatment, the hysteria of 9/11. The guards who held him in custody didn't know whether he was a material witness. They didn't know if he had ties to the hijackers. They didn't know if he was partially responsible for 9/11. All they knew was that he was being detained in connection with the 9/11 investigation.
So, Osama, how did they treat you?
Well, you want to take it one period of it, you know, at a time. On September 20th, was coming back from my school, heading to my home to take a rest, and I have another class that I want to go back to. And here I was surprised with 6 or 7 cars parked in front of my apartment. 20 FBI agents approach me, and it's like it's like if I have done something that I was shocked, you know, for all these people to come, and they start, you know, questioning me, are you Osama bin Laden? All these questions, and they show them my ID and said, okay, we need to talk to you about, you know, ask you a few questions. Then I said, okay, we'll just go to my apartment, do something, and, you know, come out. And actually, I wanted to go and use the bathroom. And the FBI agent refused to close the door on myself. And that's, in my religion, it's very important, it's very serious that, you know, when you are doing some private stuff, no one intervene or anything. And that was...
He refused to allow you to close the bathroom door.
Yes. And that was the spark or the first incident that made me start to be confused and, you know, afraid and all these, you know, surroundings even around me. Since that time until the last day of grand jury, which is October 15th, it was just a series of mistreatment, unbelievable, ridiculous treatment in a way that a human being cannot be treated. And then we went to the FBI office. They questioned me for about 8 hours.
Did you have a lawyer
constantly
present?
No, I didn't have a lawyer. They told me it's going to be a short time, you don't need anyone to be with you, you're going to be fine, just, you know, a few questions, then you will go home. I said, it's fine, you know. And remember, at that time, I'm 20 years old, you know. My English at that time is not like what I'm speaking with you right now. It's completely different, you know. It's been only 2 years in the country, or a year and a half, and...
Was there an Arabic speaker there?
No, there wasn't an interpreter nor an Arabic speaker. Then they questioned me all day until 10, 11 midnight. And I was so exhausted that I just wanted to go home. I even was going to answer whatever they want just in order just to get home and, you know, rest. My family didn't know where I am. Everyone was worried. My community were looking for me. And I came at 11 o'clock. I went to my brothers, and there I told them what happened with me. And the second day, the FBI... Well, actually, on that day, on September 20th, they asked me that they want to come the next day to continue questioning. I said, well, I've just said everything that you want, you know, I have. Why this other day? They said, well, there's a couple of questions we need to verify. I said, okay. Then the second day at 6 o'clock in the morning, they came to my apartment, and I drove with them. I told them it was a Friday, and there was the Friday service, and I told them I have to catch my Friday service, so I hope this won't take much time. I said, no, yeah, no problem. Then we went there. They started confronting me with things more, you know, in a more high tone than the previous day, and they started jumping me. This time there were four people who's asking me questions, not like one. You know, it's like you have a person in there and you have four people asking you questions at the same time. So you have to answer this. All this pressure and stress that, you know, came in, then at the end they said, you know what, I guess you're going to go to New York right now. Right now we're going to put you in a plane and ship you to New York, just like this. And from there, you know, continued, went to MCC jail and then Oklahoma, I think San Bernardino, sheriff jail, then they took me to Oklahoma jail, then ended up with New York. And until then, that's all that happened.
And they were questioning you about your knowledge of two of the hijackers.
Correct. And well, not about two of the hijackers, general questions about, you know, who do you know in the community. Yes, there were some specific questions about, you know, people that, regarding two of the hijackers, but that came later more extensively. But at the beginning was more of a general questions, whom do you talk to, who are your friends, do you know these people, do you know if, you know, they were doing or intending to do anything like that.
When you were brought before the grand jury, you were in handcuffs?
Yes, I was.
We're going to go to break and then come back. We are speaking with Osama Odala and his attorney, Sarah Kunstler. Stay with us.
Cáscara, pega, mata e come. Cáscara, vai morrer de fome. Cáscara, mais coragem do que homem. Cáscara, pega, mata e come. Cáscara, lá no sertão. É bicho que voa que nem avião. Ou pássaro malvado, tem bico volteado que nem gavião. Carcará, quando vê roça queimada, sai voando e cantando. Carcará, vai fazer sua caçada. Carcará, com vinte é cobra queimada. Mas quando chega o tempo da invernada, no sertão não tem mais roça queimada. Carcará, mesmo assim não passa fome, os burregos que nascem na baixada. Carcará, pega, mata e come. Carcará, vai morrer de fome. Carcará, mais coragem do que homem. Carcará, pega, mata e come. Carcará é malvado, é valentão.
Zalia Barbosa here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In this exclusive interview, we're talking with Osama Awadallah, the Jordanian student who was acquitted on Friday of federal charges that he lied to a grand jury investigating the September 11th attacks. He joins us in studio along with his attorney, Sarah Kunstler. So you were handcuffed before the grand jury. One of the jurors, after the trial on Friday, after the verdict was read, said they were particularly disturbed about how you were treated. Why were you handcuffed during the grand jury testimony? Were your hands behind your back?
No, it was handcuffed to a chair in the grand jury. But you know, this came along, I mean, from a long process of, you know, using that. All the shackles and handcuffs. It wasn't like, you know, this was actually the easiest that, you know, I had, you know, in terms of handcuffing. But he used to have the three-piece suit, what they call a three-piece suit, where my feet were shackled and my waist connected to my hands.
That's called the three-piece suit?
Correct. Why they handcuffed me in the grand jury? Well, first of all, they treated me as a high-risk inmate. And they told me on San Diego that you are a material witness. But that did not came to be true. It came like they treated me as even one of the hijackers, as if, you know, a person who has so much great danger to the community and to the people around him, as if I am criminal, or, you know, things like that. And when they took me to the grand jury, they were afraid that I might do something or harm the jurors or the grand jury that were sitting in that room, or I might flee. I mean, I'm surrounding with 10 marshals and handcuffed and been all this solitary confinement all these 20 days, and they still think, and they know I'm a material witness. But because of what happens and the situation we're around at that time, everyone was angry, and they justified their abuse to me by relating, oh, we're having such a hard time these days, and it's complete security, and so it cannot be justified in any way, but that's what, you know, they did.
Sarah Kunstler, what does it do to a grand jury when they see the person testifying in handcuffs?
We actually tried to get the indictment dismissed when we found out that Mr. Awadallah was handcuffed in the jury room, on the basis that seeing him in handcuffs prejudiced the grand jury against him, because it made them afraid of him. It made them suspect that he was guilty of something already or capable of violence. It's terribly prejudicial for a grand jury to see a witness come in handcuffs. It suggests all sorts of things about that person.
And let me add up, this handcuffing me to the chair was one of the main reasons that I was answering those weird questions on the grand jury. They had so much stress in me. That's one of the reasons. There were other reasons, but this one was also, you know, contributed to me forgetting the answers and, you know, being under stress, being nervous and afraid. All these things, they have added up into what I have said in the grand jury at that day. And that's how, you know, the government did it. You know, they played it right, and that's what happened at the end.
The authorities allege that Osama Awadallah knew Nawaf al-Hazmi, who helped seize the plane that crashed into the Pentagon. But the two perjury counts stem from two statements he made to the grand jury regarding another hijacker, Khalid al-Midar. Explain those charges, Sarah.
Those charges were based on Mr. Awadallah's inability to recall the second man's name when he was being questioned in the grand jury. Mr. Awadallah was able to describe the second man. He was able to accurately recall how many times he'd seen the second man, the extent of his relationship with the second man. Unlike Mr. Awadallah had actually met Nawaf al-Hazmi on several occasions and knew his name.
You knew him from San Diego, from the mosque?
Yes.
But he had no interactions with the second man. He had seen him accompanying Nawaf al-Hazmi and may have been introduced to him, but had no personal interactions with this other person.
And why did they charge him with perjury? Because of the name, remembering the name?
They charged him with perjury because at one point he had known this other man's name. And when he appeared before the grand jury after 20 days of being shackled and chained and beaten and abused, when he testified before the grand jury, he was unable to come up with the second man's name.
The jury forewoman, Alma Weinstein of Rockland County, said the panel wasn't convinced the statements at issue in the case were of any importance to the terror probe. Were you surprised by the verdict, Osama?
Well, I wasn't surprised so much. Yes, there was some surprise to it, but I knew myself. I knew I were innocent. And this time we have changed the way we picked up the jury. We were more careful of, you know, things of what to ask and how to interact. And it's been 5 years since September 11, and people will never forget, you know, such an event. But I think I believed that I would be acquitted in both counts. I didn't have a doubt that this couldn't be happen. I knew it would happen, but I still had some, you know, like fear of, you know, some people might not leave their feelings alone and regarding September 11 and put this away and just try the case solely on what happened on that days without just relating to what happened to, you know, feelings and their friends and their experience with September 11. That was my only fear and doubt, but I had a 90% belief that the jury will, the indictment will be acquitted.
And what are your plans now?
My plans is now I'm going to continue my master.
What are you getting a degree in?
Well, I had a degree now in information system, and my master will be a doctor, as a medical doctor, and then maybe get married as soon as possible, and just, you know, look for the best job or, you know, find a good job and just continue into my life.
And you will stay in this country?
Absolutely.
And Sarah Kunstler, how typical is what happened to Osama Awadallah?
You know, unfortunately, I think it's more typical than we would like to believe or would want. You know, it's I think the test of our civility is how we treat people in those moments after tremendous tragedies like September 11th, and it's at those times when maintaining your When treating people well and giving people the presumption of innocence and not criminalizing people because of who they know and or how they look or what they believe is most important. And if Osama's case teaches us anything, it's that we need to be careful, very careful in those moments on how we pass judgments on other people and how we treat them.
Sarah Kunstler, thanks very much for being with us. Sarah also is the daughter of William Kunstler, the famed attorney, a late attorney, also based in New York, and Osama Awadallah. Did you want to add one more thing?
Yes, I just want to say another thing. This case was very important, not just only for me, for thousands and thousands of people who have been through my situations. You know, I've been treated so badly that bring the image of how our government here in the United States act with people, you know, in a such a way, in a harsh way. There were many people in this country waiting for this case, and I hope it would, the government would rethink their the way they interact with prisoners or teenage witnesses or those people who have been held up for nothing, you know, just. And I would thank all those people who stood with me, you know, starting from my lawyers, people in San Diego, people in my country. And I would like to thank all of those who prayed for me. And I wish good for everybody. And I wish nothing such a thing would happen again to anyone else.
And the advice you would give to someone caught up in the same situation that you were, now that you've gone through it all of these years?
Well, if someone are in my situation and they still, you know, I would say have patience, and there are people for you staying, you know, or outside, you know, calling for justice. And also people have to be careful of whom they're dealing with. You know, I learned my lessons. And
in what way?
Knowing who you deal with. You know, sometimes you might not be able to distinguish between a good person or a bad person, but it's good also always to be more careful, you know, and just...
Are you talking about the authorities or people in your community?
Well, both, especially the authority. I mean, the authority always... I mean, and the way it happened with me, they seemed so friendly to me at the beginning that then they turned out to be, you know, like monsters against me, and they come and even testify in my court completely different of what happened and of how they talked to me, how they treated me, especially, you know, those FBI agents that they tried, you know, to question me. So be careful. Always have a lawyer with you. Never speak with someone without having someone with you who knows the law, And everyone should know that he has a rights in his country, in this country, and he should use them to his best extent.
Osama Owadala and attorney Sarah Kunstler, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
As we move on to our next story today, officials at the University of California, Los Angeles are launching an independent investigation into campus police officers' repeated shocking of an Iranian-American student with a taser stun gun. The incident took place last Tuesday evening in a UCLA library filled with students studying for their midterm exams. The student, Mustafa Tabatabanejad, a 23-year-old senior, was in the library's computer lab. The campus police ordered him to leave after he failed to produce a student ID. Police then handcuffed Mustafa and shocked him with a taser gun at least five times. The entire incident was captured on video by another student and has been widely seen on local TV news and the website YouTube. In the video, Mustafa can be heard screaming, "I said I would leave," after police repeatedly shock him with the taser gun.
I got tased for no reason. I was leaving this godforsaken place. You stopped me. You're abusing your power. Here's your justice at work, University of
Stand up. Stand up. Stand up.
You just shot him up. You just
stand up.
Stand up or you'll get tased again.
Stand up. Get up. Get up. Stand up.
Don't do that.
Stand up.
Get up or you'll get tased again.
Don't.
Get up. Stand up. Get up.
So wrong.
Get up. Stand up! Ass up! Alright, come stand up!
Mustafa was stunned at least five times. That video you can see on our website at democracynow.org for our radio listeners. Mustafa's attorney, Stephen Yagman, said he plans to file a federal civil rights lawsuit accusing the UCLA police of a brutal, excessive force as well as false arrest. He said Mustafa initially refused to show his ID because he thought he was being singled out because of his Middle Eastern appearance. Mustafa is of Iranian descent, but a U.S. citizen by birth and a resident of Los Angeles. Meanwhile, more than 200 UCLA students marched to the university police station Friday, calling for an independent investigation and the suspension of the officers involved. Hours later, the university announced a veteran L.A. law enforcement watchdog would head up the probe. Merrick Bob served as staff attorney for the Christopher Commission, which was formed to examine allegations of excessive force in the Los Angeles Police Department after the Rodney King beating in the early 90s. Hassam Ailush joins us now on the telephone. He's executive director of the Southern California Council on American-Islamic Relations, which has also called for an independent investigation. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Can you explain what has developed from this point as of Tuesday when the attack took place?
Well, when we first received the report of the attack from various students on campus, you can just look at the—you know, we're getting half the picture by listening to it today, and the same thing with your listeners. It's only when you watch the video that you feel how the full extent of how disturbing the imagery is. We were extremely disturbed, and we immediately called for an independent investigation because we felt that such a disturbing incident requires an impartial review and probe. Since then, initially the university announced an internal review that will be conducted by their own University of California Police Department. But I think after the actions taken by the students on campus, led by the Muslim Student Association there and many supporting groups from Latino groups to African-American groups and various social justice groups there, I think the university realized how serious it is. I could say the whole community is shaken by it, not only the student body, but even the parents, the whole community, because we as parents and the community send their children to the university thinking it's a safe place. This is not a way to treat a student. I'll tell you what I heard from parents. People are saying, yes, maybe Mustafa was a little bit obnoxious, maybe he wasn't too compliant. We don't have the whole picture, actually, but based on what we've heard from news reports, it seems, yeah, maybe initially he was asked for an ID and he didn't show the ID. But he never showed any violence. He was never threatening to any of the officers or anybody else. So if the goal was to detain him, to hold him, there were enough officers at that time to hold him and handcuff him, but there was no need to use the taser on him.
Looking at an article that from ABC News, quoting the University of California Police Department Assistant Chief Jeff Young, telling the ABC News affiliate KABC-TV, I think we need to focus on the actions of the person, not just what you're hearing on the tape as far as the words. He refused to identify himself. He had refused to leave the library. And he also, when he was escorted by the officers at first, he went limp, which is a form of resistance, Young said. Hassam Ailush, your response.
Well, again, we only have the images from the video to determine what really happened, plus the eyewitnesses' account. And it's too early to make a judgment, a final complete conclusion on what happened. That's why we demand the investigation. But just judging by what we see someone who's resisting. But according to law enforcement, because I do work with law enforcement people, and all of them said, this seems to be, because there is a differentiation between resistance. There is something called passive resistance, which is going limp like what Mustafa was doing, and there is active resistance, where you start pushing around and trying to harm somebody else. And according to the policy of all police departments that I work with, including the sheriff departments also, tasers should not be used when the person is involved in passive resistance. What they say, the policy is, tasers should be used against persons who are actively resisting or to prevent those individuals from harming themselves or others. In this case, it's very, very clear, at least from the video itself, Mustafa was involved in neither. He wasn't actively resisting. He was passively resisting, and he was never threatening anybody, nor seemed to be threatening anybody. So, now, according to them, it seems like the policy, that's what the gentleman had been saying in media, is that the policy for the UC Police Department actually is more flexible than the rest of the police departments in the area. And that is, it allows them to use the taser's technique, basically pain-inducing weapons, against students or against individuals, even if it's not active resistance, which is extremely concerning because that means they're allowed to use brutality against students on campus at a time when the larger police department dealing with real criminals outside has more restrictive policy. So if that is true, if that is the case, then there's certainly a need and a demand to change that policy.
We're talking to Hassam Ailush, Executive Director of Southern California CARE, that's Council on American Islamic Relations. Four of UCLA's nearly 60 full-time police officers recently won taser awards given by the manufacturers of the electronic shock device to law enforcement officers, quote, who save a life in the line of duty through extraordinary use of the taser. This according to the Los Angeles Times. We come back. I want to ask one more question on this issue, then talk to you about CNN's Glenn Beck's comments when he was interviewing the first Muslim member of Congress. Stay with us. That's Fad Gadget, Ark of the Aorta, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're talking about the tasering of Mostafa Tabatabai-Najad, an Iranian-American student at UCLA last Tuesday. And we're talking with the head of the Southern California Council on Islamic Relations, Executive Director Hassam Ailush. According to a study published in the Lancet Medical Journal in 2001, a charge of 3 to 5 seconds of a taser gun can result in immobilization for 5 to 15 minutes, which would mean that Mostafa could have been physically unable to stand when the officers demanded that he do so. The incident follows the recent announcement that four of the campus police won the so-called taser awards, as I said before break, from the manufacturer. This is the last question on this issue before we turn to Glenn Beck. Hassam, but have you talked to Mostafa?
Not personally, I haven't done so, but I know people on campus have done so, people we've worked with from the Muslim student associations and others. And I know currently he's not personally making any comments anymore since he has hired an attorney. What I want to add is on the issue of the taser itself very quickly, I think there was a recent study by the ACLU that shows that since 1999, 148 people have died as a result of the use of taser. So that really brings us to the really larger picture in the whole issue, and that is the use of such brutal tactics in the attempt to arrest people. I think it also leads to the underlying issue, and that is the culture of violence that is sweeping our country and the world today, where we as individuals become so desensitized to the pain and the suffering of other people. And we witness this maybe in the arrest of individuals, but also we see it in what happens in the Abu Ghraib, in the Guantanamo Bay prisons, in the way the police brutality cases we hear, whether it's against Iraqi prisoners, against Afghani prisoners, or even against our own American detainees. And I think this should maybe be a wake-up call for us. And we need to change this culture of violence that is taking over.
Hassam Ailush, I wanted to turn to a second issue that sparked controversy earlier this month. On November 14th edition of a CNN headline news program, host Glenn Beck interviewed Keith Ellison, the Minneapolis Congress member who will become the first Muslim ever elected to Congress. He was elected, of course, November 7th. And this is an excerpt of the interview that Glenn Beck did with him.
I will tell you, may we have 5 minutes here where we're just politically incorrect and I play the cards face up on the table?
Go there.
Okay. No offense, and I know Muslims, I like Muslims, I've been to mosques, I really don't believe that Islam is a religion of evil. I think it's being hijacked, quite frankly. With that being said, you are a Democrat, you are saying, let's cut and run. And I have to tell you, I have been nervous about this interview with you because what I feel like saying is, sir, prove to me that you are not working with our enemies. And I know you're not. I'm not accusing you of being an enemy, but that's the way I feel. And I think a lot of Americans will feel that way.
Well, let me tell you, the people of the 5th Congressional District know that I have a deep love and affection for my country. There's no one who is more patriotic than I am. And so, you know, I don't need to prove my patriotic stripes.
That was the newly elected congressmember from Minneapolis, Keith Ellison, first Muslim to be elected to Congress in the United States, being interviewed by CNN's Glenn Beck. Hassam Ailush, your response.
Well, I would say that's why he won election for Congress, because he's a diplomat. Probably he could hold his temper. If it was me, I would have said, I am extremely offended. What Mr. Beck did is nothing short of total bigotry. To question the patriotism of an American citizen who happens to be Muslim, because he's questioning the issues of Iraq, the failed immoral policies of this administration, is nothing short of pure racism and bigotry. And if this was tried on a Jewish person or a black person or any other person, he would not have to continue his show after that. Unfortunately, we live at a time where it is the only acceptable bigotry today, open bigotry, is the one against Muslims. No one has the right to question the patriotism of American Muslims. someone who is born and raised in this country, such as a patriot, a true patriot, such as Keith Ellison. And it's a shameful thing, because if it's ignorance from the part of Beck, then that is shameful, but it's, if it's something that is intentional, it's even more painful to us. And it seems this is something that that is going on for a while. This is not the first time Mr. Beck makes anti-Muslim comments. It seems that Mr. Beck is CNN's response to losing the bigoted segment of its viewers to Fox, and they're trying to win it back. And the way to do it is by bringing people like him to come and make, to use scare tactics, Islamophobic scare tactics.
Will CARE be issuing a letter of protest to CNN?
Actually, we're looking into it, not only from this comment. This was on our mailing. This was sent to our members when it happened. But also, we're looking at a long list of anti-Muslim comments made almost on a daily basis on his show. Mr. Beck seems to enjoy focusing on the fringe element within the Muslim extremist segment, forgetting about the existence of extremists in all religions and all groups, focusing on the media shock or the shocking image of extremists, in a way to create this scare and fear of Muslims in America.
Well, Hussam Ailush, I want to thank you for being with us, Executive Director of the Southern California Council on American-Islamic Relations. As we turn now to our last segment, longtime advocate and activist Dr. Mike Akley died on Saturday in Oakland, California. He lived with AIDS for more than 20 years. He died of leukemia. He was the Oakland director of the Cannabis Buyers Cooperative, a free medical marijuana clinic under Proposition 215. That proposition legalizes medical marijuana in California. Dr. Alkaley lived with AIDS, was a medical marijuana patient himself, a pediatrician as well, a veteran. Mike Alkaley was the founder of the Migrant Farm Workers Clinic in Watsonville, California, and had used his medical skills all over the world, including Britain, Germany, Kenya, Mexico, and Nicaragua. This is Dr. Alkaley being interviewed 2 years ago for the Steppin' Out of Babylon radio series.
I see the medical marijuana movement as part of a much larger movement that actually is global now, and it has to do with economic and social justice. And most of it you're not going to hear in the corporate media. It's all below the radar. But anybody who's in these various movements, the tentacles are linking together. You know, Pacifica Radio is part of it. Air America is now a part of it. The Internet, in great measure, is a part of it. And we're coming together in ways that the other side doesn't even want to acknowledge or will do everything to stop. But we're in the great majority.
Mike Alkaley on the radio several years ago. He died this weekend of leukemia. Glenn Alkaley is Mike's brother. He's an anthropologist here in New York. We welcome you to Democracy Now! And condolences on the loss of Mike.
Thank you, Amy.
Mike was a remarkable humanitarian activist. I co-hosted, I think it was the 6th International AIDS Conference with Mike when he was, well, in the first years of his diagnosis with AIDS many years ago. He lived, he was so healthy for so long, it was remarkable.
Yeah, he was one of those medical textbook cases of a person living with AIDS. And he was actually in it from the very beginning. He was infected in 1986 and went through a lot of different trials. Every type of trial he was involved with. There was one famous one in Stanford. He used to commute down to Stanford twice a week for those trials, and then that eventually led to AZT. Actually, those trials, and so he's one of these survivors. Had been a survivor living with AIDS.
He was a remarkable communicator, also was the producer of the radio program AIDS in Focus for a number of years. Briefly summarize Mike's life for our listeners and viewers who didn't know him. For anyone who didn't know him, it's a loss.
Well, he was an incredible person. I'm a little biased here, my older brother. After med school, went into the Army. That was the deal. He had to spend a year in Vietnam, so he was a captain and then eventually a major. Then he came back, lived in the Bay Area, and started a health clinic, as you mentioned, in Watsonville. And he actually had the idea of bringing down doctors and nurses to volunteer with the farm workers, the migrant farm workers in California. And he saw that the farm workers, though they were invisible, they were illegal, but their children's illnesses were not invisible. So he had the idea to set up in an old warehouse a clinic, exam tables, actually took a look at the children of the farm workers. That eventually turned into a very large clinic in Watsonville.
And then his activism, pediatrician, how did he get into radio?
That's a good question. He was always interested in video, film, media, radio. It was actually quite natural.
And the whole Cannabis Buyers Club.
Yes. He got involved with that about 12, 13 years ago or so. Actually grew Sensimilia in his backyard in his Oakland home and distributed for free. Had written over 1,000 prescriptions, medical marijuana prescriptions in California, which are legal. So then he became the medical director for the Oakland Cannabis Cooperative.
And was a spokesperson for that right to the end of his days.
Yes, indeed.
He's survived by his two grown-up twin sons.
Yes.
And you, and his greater community, family.
Yes.
What did Mike want to be remembered for?
That's a really good question. I think just all the people's lives that he touched.
He went down to New Orleans in January.
He was in New Orleans in January. He believes that's where he contracted the leukemia, uterine leukemia, a very rare, fast-spreading leukemia. And the two causes of that particular leukemia are radiation and benzene. He's convinced that he was exposed to benzene while he was covering a story in New Orleans in January. And then on top of his AIDS, his already compromised immune system probably exacerbated the leukemia.
The funeral?
There's going to be a memorial in January, and anybody who knew Michael in the Bay Area, please contact KPFA, the local station, Pacifica station in Berkeley. They will have all the details sometime. We haven't set the date yet, but in January.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Glenn, for joining us. You, who also have been a longtime activist around the issue of nuclear testing in the South Pacific, brought to the attention of Americans what was happening there with the French nuclear testing. And thank you for your work as well.
Thank you very much, Amy.
And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a transcript of today's show, you can go to our website at democracynow.org or see any of the video footage that we brought you today. The Breaking the Sound Barrier tour continues around the country. You can go to our website at democracynow.org to see where we're headed next. Also, my column by the same title is now being picked up by newspapers around the country, and you can call your local newspaper and ask them to pick it up as we take on issues that don't get picked up very much by the corporate media to break the sound barrier. Again, you can get information at our website, democracynow.org, where you can also see or listen to the broadcast for those who haven't gotten a chance to see it today. Tell your friends. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Aaron Mate, Lee Burek, Jen Utes, Mike DeFilippo, and Nick Marsilio are our engineers. Special thanks to Megan Whitney, John Randolph, Kieran Krug Meadows, Peter Yoon, Danielle Strandberg Peshkin, Angela Alston, Uri Galed, Hugh Gran. Again, that website is democracynow.org, where you can also sign up for our daily headlines. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.